program, and I want to thank all of you, and we'll be back tomorrow. I'd like to get in a little bit in something Wayne said tomorrow, which is the whole issue of the widening gap between rich and poor in society and what it means for working people and what it means for everybody else. So I invite you to be with us tomorrow, beginning at noon Eastern Time, 3 hours early on the West Coast. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
This is the Quality News Network. A hurricane watch now in effect for the Bahamas, with the tropical storm Chris approaching with sustained winds of 65 miles an hour and showing signs of strengthening. The eastern U.S. still suffering from a record-setting heat wave, which will again be delivering triple-digit heat indexes today from St. Louis to Boston. Utilities throughout the region say that customer demand for power has reached or is exceeding record highs. Despite continuing violence, Iraq's president says that Iraqi forces will take over security for all 18 Iraqi provinces by the end of this year. Right now, U.S. forces are responsible for all but one of them. CNN and AP both reporting that evidence collected by the Pentagon supports accusations that Marines deliberately shot 24 civilians in Haditha, Iraq, last November. The military is still weighing whether to file criminal charges, but one of those Marines is now suing a Congressman John Murtha for accusing him publicly of murder and war crimes. Israel continues to move deeper into Lebanon with another 8,000 to 10,000 troops and claiming to have captured 5 Hezbollah guerrillas and killed 10 in a raid near the Syrian border. Israeli air raids also killed at least 15 civilians in a town 70 miles north of the border and attacked a Lebanese army base in the southern part of the country, killing 3 soldiers. Hezbollah guerrillas have hit back, firing a barrage into northern Israel of more than 200 rockets today, the most ever, including one that landed in the Palestinian-controlled West Bank, nearly 70 miles south of the Israeli-Lebanese border. Diplomatic efforts to end the fighting are at an impasse. France says it will not participate in tomorrow's UN meeting to discuss sending international troops to the area. France says there must first be a ceasefire. A statement purportedly from Fidel Castro says the Cuban president's health is stable and his spirits are good, but he hasn't been seen in public since intestinal surgery earlier this week prompted him to temporarily hand power over to his brother. 17 Western governors are urging Congress to pass emergency drought aid legislation, saying that with no relief from the weather in sight, farmers and ranchers, their livestock and crops are all suffering greatly. As many as 10,000 North Koreans are reported to be dead or missing in what's being called that country's worst flooding in a century, flooding caused by 2 weeks of heavy rainfall last month. Conservative Republicans have lost their majority on the Kansas State Board of Education, which under their control had ordered evolution to be taught in schools as a questionable theory. And the space shuttle Atlantis has moved to the launch pad in advance of its scheduled liftoff on August 27th from the Kennedy Space Center. This is the Quality News Network. Business news is next.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
U.S. mortgage applications fell again last week to their lowest level in more than 4 years. Nike founder Philip Knight, a Stanford alumnus, is giving Stanford University's Graduate School of Business a record $105 million gift which will be used to build a new facility to be named after him. Procter & Gamble posting a higher fiscal fourth quarter profit, but concedes that its earnings in the current quarter and the fiscal year may be below Wall Street's expectations. While U.S. carmakers experienced double-digit declines in sales in July, Toyota posting a 16% increase in sales, moving it for the first time past Ford into the number two spot in this country. Google has struck a deal with XM Satellite Radio to allow the search engine's advertisers to automatically insert ads on the radio company's non-music channels. AOL says it will be giving away email accounts from now on and software now available only to its paying customers. And Time Warner, the parent company of AOL, as well as HBO and CNN, reporting a second quarter profit of $1 billion in contrast to a $400 million loss a year ago. Gold is trading this hour at $660 an ounce. Silver is at $12.15. Light sweet crude oil, $75.95 a barrel, up $1.04 from yesterday's close. On Wall Street, the market is up. The Dow Jones Industrial is higher by 89 points at 11,215. NASDAQ is up by 25. The S&P 500 up by 11. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. It's been a decade, 10 years, since Congress has last increased the minimum wage. And at this time, we have wages falling. But CEOs are doing well. The heads of major corporations are making hundreds of millions of dollars and apparently able to avoid taxes on it to boot. Well, the House of Representatives, controlled by the Republican Party, has an answer. They, of course, have tried for years to refuse to raise the minimum wage. The Democrats, every time they tried to increase the wage, the Republicans voted it down. And now it's coming to an election year where the Republicans know that they're in trouble. So they're going to allow an increase in minimum wage, according to the House, with one little caveat. They want to attach to it an estate tax cut that removes three-quarters of estate taxes. It would cost some $753 billion. And to show how much they hate working people, the Republicans in the House have determined that they will help the people who don't work at all. Those 8,000 heirs or so of people who die will make a cool million each. All of that just to give working people a chance at increase in the minimum wage. To discuss this bill and the overall problem of the wages going down and the minimum wage being too low, I've invited the legislative director of the AFL-CIO. His name is Bill Samuel. Bill, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with the minimum wage. I want to get to this bill a little bit later on in the broadcast. Let's just talk about the minimum wage in general. It's been 10 years since it's gone up. How does this affect ordinary workers, both those at the minimum wage and those working at a little bit higher levels?
Well, I mean, just imagine trying to make it on $5.15 an hour, which if you work 40 hours a week full-time, your annual income will be $10,700. I can't imagine living practically anywhere in this country and getting by on $10,700. Imagine trying to feed your kids, pay rent, pay
the poverty
car
level. I think is poverty about
level
what?
For a family of three. I think is around $16,000. So if you've got a couple of kids and you're the primary breadwinner, which more than half of minimum wage workers are, you're going to be substantially below the poverty level.
Now, these statistics, I think, are very important because I think a lot of people don't understand it. You say that more than half of people earning minimum wage are primary breadwinners because Republicans would argue they're all teenage kids getting summer jobs.
That's exactly right. They trot this out every time we have a debate about the minimum wage. The fact is 7 out of every 10 workers are adults. And on average, minimum wage workers contribute more than half of their family's income. More than a third are the sole providers for their family. But they're not primarily kids making money after school.
How many people are we talking about here? How many Americans earn minimum wage?
Well, there's about 1.5 million minimum wage workers, that is, people actually earning the minimum wage. There's another about 6.5 million who would benefit from the increase because they're earning between $5.15 an hour and $7.25. So if the if the Congress did pass the minimum wage that we've been pushing, and Democrats primarily on the Hill have been pushing, about close to 7 million people would immediately see an increase in their wages from between $5.15 to $7.25. There's another 8 million whose wages would probably rise, and this is based on the fact that they're just above $7.25 now, and their wages would probably increase at the same time.
And I would think that the people who have earned over the minimum wage would expect an increase as well when the minimum wage goes up.
That's right.
So now tell me this. What are the costs? Because the Republicans would argue that, well, if you do this, then the costs to businesses go up and the cost of products go up. Can you tell me whether that's true? And if so, how much cost are we talking about here?
Well, I'm not really sure there are any costs. They've never been able to demonstrate a negative impact, employment losses, job losses, following an increase in minimum wage, either at the federal level or at state level. When states have acted independently to raise their own minimum wage, and right now there are 22 states that have a higher minimum wage than the federal. In fact, in 1996, the last time Congress voted to raise the minimum wage, that was followed by the longest sustained growth in our economy in half a century. Similarly, in New Jersey, after they raised the minimum wage, job numbers improved, wages improved. And really, if you're going to look at sort of economic theory, you have to imagine that if we're putting more money in the pockets of people who are going to spend it on food, on clothing, on housing, it's actually going to act as a kind of prime the pump in that local community. So it's actually a good thing to put this wage increase in effect.
I've never understood the Republican argument that transferring money from the poor to the wealthy helps the economy. It seems to me that if 1,000 people at the lower end of the scale have 1,000 more dollars, they're going to need to use that money to feed their families. And if one guy who's already making $7 million gets $1 million more, that's the same 1,000 times 1,000, he'll just stick it in the bank, and that won't help the economy that much. But what's interesting to me is that since the Clinton era is over, since we have the Bush tax cuts, which in effect do transfer large amounts of money from the poor to the rich, we haven't seen the kind of economic growth that we saw in the Clinton years.
That's right. Well, there have been a lot of studies which have shown that the tax cuts, particularly those for upper income Americans, for investors, whether it's the capital gains or the dividend tax cut. Now, of course, we're debating the estate tax cut, as you pointed out, for the 8,000 wealthiest families in America. There's really little evidence that has helped stimulate the economy. The one tax cut that Bush really grudgingly agreed to early in the administration was that rebate. And people probably forget that they got, I think it was a $300 rebate.
That was for socialist Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
Well, it was a Democrat's idea. Exactly right.
No, a socialist idea, the only independent socialist we have in the Congress.
Everybody thinks it was a Republican idea. It was actually the one Democratic idea that Republicans stole and included in that first tax cut in 2001. That actually probably did help and may have done something to help local communities. Again, it's a stimulus when you can put money into the pockets of middle and low income people because they're going to turn around and spend it in restaurants and shoe stores, as we just talked about, and that's going to help boost employment. But there's really no evidence that raising minimum wage has cost anybody a job. Frankly, although I hate to cite Walmart, 6 months ago the CEO of Walmart actually said that they wanted the minimum wage increase because they wanted people to be able to afford to shop in their stores, and they felt that would help boost their sales if the minimum wage went up.
Henry Ford once said, and I actually hate to quote him as well for other reasons, but Henry Ford said that I have to pay my workers enough on the assembly line so they can afford to buy my Model Ts.
That's sort of the
same principle out there. Let me ask you about overall wage levels just in America, because obviously, as you point out, it's not just the people earning minimum wage, but people earning slightly above or maybe even middle-income families that will do better off if the minimum wage passes. What are the overall levels? Is it true, and can we quantify that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer in America?
Oh, absolutely. Wages have been stagnant for some time now. In the last 3 years, they've actually dropped below the cost of living. So whatever meager increases people have been able to get either through collective bargaining or just from staying on the job, the gains from those increases have been lost to inflation. So workers' incomes are falling behind inflation, and that hasn't happened in quite some time. That's the last 2 or 3 years. But wages have been basically stagnant for middle-income families, working families, for quite a long time.
And what's interesting to me is that if you look at the data, you see that for middle income, for lower middle income, even for many upper middle income workers, the wages have gone down, the real wages after inflation have gone down. But for the super rich, they're doing better off than ever before.
They're doing very well. And profits are up, productivity is up. And the real crime is that wages are no longer tied to productivity. It used to be that when productivity improved, when workers were producing more for the same amount of money, which is the productivity, the way they measure productivity, they got raises. And that's how our economy worked. That's how we built the middle class through the 50s and 60s. But because of globalization, because of the decline in collective bargaining power that unions had at one time, the companies now take those productivity gains, and they plow it right back into profits, into CEO compensation and pay, and I think we know the result. It's, as I said, the economy is flat, and most middle-income families are just barely treading water.
One of the things I find most interesting is that the CEOs that ruin their companies seem to get the highest pay increases. Disney is the classic example. But what's interesting to me is that I remember back to the welfare reform debate in 1996, and the Republicans were saying, don't reward people that don't work. And they were attacking welfare mothers and others that have difficulty working and raising children, finding child care, and so forth. And without revisiting that debate, what interests me about the present debate is they want to reward precisely the people that don't work, the people that do absolutely nothing but happen to have a rich uncle who dies, or do absolutely nothing but happen to have money in the bank, and they want to punish people who actually work for a living. And I don't know that this message is getting out. I don't know. Is labor trying to get that message out?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, wage earners pay the highest taxes now. That's where most of our taxes come from. Corporate taxes are at historic lows. You know, the share of our revenue that the government used to take from individual versus corporations has shifted dramatically in the direction of individuals. And, of course, payroll taxes have remained high, and that's what funds Social Security and Medicare. Meanwhile, we're cutting corporate taxes, the estate tax, dividends, capital gains, and so as a share of the overall income that the government or revenue that the government takes in through taxes, working families are paying more and more.
And, of course, there's all the corporate welfare as well. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We have Gene on the line. Gene, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Mr. Daniel. I have a question. I live out here in Oregon, and I was to understand that for us on the coast, the minimum wage would actually make our wages go down because it would supersede our local minimum wage laws.
That's a really good point, Gene. Let me throw that back to Bill, because I was reading in the paper today how in California people who earn tips will actually have their minimum wage go down if the House bill passes. And Gene's concerned about Oregon as well. What do you know about that, Bill?
Yeah, that's actually true. The Republicans, you know, at 1:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, when they passed the minimum wage increase, they didn't tell anybody this, but the National Restaurant Association stuck in a provision which actually is going to end up cutting pay for tipped employees. These are not just waiters and waitresses, but people who park cars, beauticians, bellhops, housekeeping in hotels, people who rely on tips. They're all going to see their pay decreased, but primarily in the 7 to 9 states that do not allow employers the so-called tip credit. Washington and California are states in that category. I don't believe Oregon is. But just to further explain that, in Washington, the state minimum wage is over $7 an hour. In Washington, tipped employees have to earn at least the minimum wage, and then they get tips on top of that. Under federal law, tipped employees are only guaranteed by federal law $2.13 an hour, and they have to make up the rest in tips. So their employers are actually allowed to pay waiters, and anybody listening to your show who's ever been a waiter or waitress knows that the federal minimum wage for them is only $2.13 rather than $5.15. But what?
So, in other words, even apart from the estate tax parts of it, some people will actually see their wages go down.
Well over a million people will see a pay cut, and these are tipped employees who lose the benefit of their state minimum wages. Again, in those 7 states that have a higher minimum wage and do not allow employers to account for tips, they actually have to pay their employees the state minimum wage. Those state laws are nullified by this federal minimum wage increase.
So actually, the Republicans who claim to care about states' rights would use federal law to overrule states that are are kinder to workers, that actually provide them a higher minimum wage. They would overrule the laws and force those workers to get less money, even though their states voted to give them more money.
And that's a really good point, because this is the first time under the federal Fair Labor Standards Act, and the minimum wage is part of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and so is the 40-hour week. This is the first time the federal government would be saying to states, you cannot provide more protection or more generous benefits. Under the FLSA since 1938 when it passed, states have always been allowed to, for example, for a long time, California had an 8-hour day, even though the federal law only guarantees a 40-hour week. What the Congress said on Friday night is we're no longer going to allow states to have more protective or more generous laws. And we're going to basically preempt them from the federal at the federal level. So it's a big change, and there's a lot at stake.
There is a lot at stake, and we have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to ask Bill about the difficulty of labor, which has worked for 10 years, to get an increase in minimum wage, faced with a bill where the Republicans have very cannily put in help for some workers, certainly, at the expense of other workers and at the expense, really, of a very large estate tax cut for the super rich. We'll be right back. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Hi. My name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell. They say it's from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote, and then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found the first sign. A small, discolored hard patch of plastic on my right shoulder. I thought it would go away on its own, but it didn't. Kept spreading, and when I could no longer conceal it with a t-shirt, I knew I had to see the doctor. He said I had this early stage of mannequinism and that my only hope was to get involved, even if it was something simple. So I began reading the newspaper and instantly got feeling back in my arm. I guess you could say I'm living proof you can fight mannequinism.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The House of Representatives, controlled by the Republican Party, has passed legislation. We'll see whether it gets anywhere in the Senate. I personally hope it does not. The legislation would increase the minimum wage for many workers in three phases, from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour. But it would also, as my guest Bill Samuels, legislative director for the AFL-CIO, has pointed out, harm workers who get a lot of their wages from tips in a number of states. And also, and perhaps more importantly, it would change the estate tax. And here's how the estate tax would change. It would get rid of three-quarters of the estate tax. It would cost the United States $753 billion, that's B, billion with a B, dollars over 10 years. To give you an idea, our deficit, massive as it is only 300-something billion, so twice the national deficit. And basically what it would do is for a couple of two, they could give up to $10 million tax-free to their kids. If they earned $50 million, they'd only have to pay 15% of the taxes on that. And for estates over $50 million, those with hundreds of millions of dollars, they'd only pay 30%. So someone earning minimum wage may well pay a higher percentage of their income when you add payroll taxes and so forth than people who do nothing but inherit hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a pretty canny idea. They can go to the voters and say that they've increased the minimum wage, just as a few years back when the Democrats proposed the Department of Homeland Security. The Republicans switched on a dime, having opposed it, and then they supported it, but as long as labor guarantees were taken away. Zach Womp, the Tennessee Republican representative, said of this bill to the House Democrats, quote, "You have seen us really outfox you on this issue tonight," unquote. As I said, my guest is Bill Samuel. He's the legislative director for the AFL-CIO. Bill, are they outfoxing you? I mean, how do you handle politically a bill that definitely gives some benefits to workers at the lowest edge of the scale but provides all of these problems?
Well, I think that every American can see through this, and certainly if you've been keeping up with the editorial pages across the country, they've seen through this as well. This is a very cynical move on the part of Republicans who for 10 years have, most Republicans, I won't say all, but most Republicans, and certainly the Republican leadership, have opposed increase in the minimum wage since 1996. Increases have been offered every year since Senator Kennedy, Congressman George Miller, and Dave Bonner before him, who was in the House, offered increases every year. It never saw the light of day until 100 days before this election that we're facing this November. And in fact, it's somewhat outrageous, I think, that people who've been waiting for a wage increase for 10 years and now have been told they can only get it if we cut the estate tax, if we cut the millionaires' taxes, the Paris Hiltons of the world, the Sam Walton heirs. Get in line behind them, essentially.
And Nicole Smith, who apparently earned her hundreds of millions of dollars, we won't say how she earned it, but I think most people know her story.
That's right. But the fact is minimum wage workers deserve this increase. They've waited long enough. And they ought to get it. And in fact, there's a majority in the House and the Senate for this $7.25 minimum wage clean. We shouldn't be attaching it to other bills, to other forms of tax cuts, particularly the estate tax. As you point out, it's going to cost over a 10-year period three-quarters of $1 trillion. So what, in a sense, you're saying to minimum wage workers is, we'll give you this raise this time, but in fact, we're going to end up cutting services that help you and your family, whether it's Medicaid or education assistance, health care for the very poor, food stamps. All kinds of programs are going to be slashed as a result of this huge cut in the estate tax. And that's the bargain that they're asking minimum wage workers and in fact, all families to accept. And I think that the Democrats have basically said no. Organized labor has certainly said no. As much as we want to see the minimum wage increased, we want to see it done the right way, and it's going to be done the right way, and we're pretty confident of that.
Well, does this pose a problem for you? I mean, obviously, labor is looking out for people at the bottom of the wage scale. Obviously, you've been promoting minimum wage for 10 years. Zach Womp thinks that he's really outfoxed you, that,
what?
In other words, the American people won't understand why they haven't gotten the minimum wage increase. How do you think you're doing on this politically?
Well, I think they're wrong, and as I said, there's been quite a bit written about this in the last few days and a lot of discussion across the country, certainly on Capitol Hill, about this sort of this bargain that is being proposed, which is again an estate tax, a cut on the tax for the wealthiest Americans and an increase in the minimum wage. Frankly, when the Congress convenes in September, when they come back from their August recess, if the Senate is successful in turning this down on Friday when they vote on the estate tax minimum wage increase, there will be enormous pressure on the Republican Party, on those moderates in the House who pushed the minimum wage increase in the first place to go back and do it again. They weren't happy about this, frankly, if you talk
to
them.
So you think there's still a chance then this year?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think the Republicans, the reason this thing passed last week with the estate tax on it is because members are afraid to go home and face the voters having not raised the minimum wage. And by the way, I don't know if you've mentioned this, Congress has voted itself pay raises in 9 of the last 10 years. And
no, that's a good point. In fact, it's more than $31,000over the last 9 years.
So, there was a vote about 2 weeks ago in the House. It was a non-binding vote, and 64 Republicans joined every Democrat to support increasing the minimum wage to $7.25 without any strings attached. Now, the leadership, they're not stupid, and they understood that they were in danger of losing their control of their caucus, so they offered their moderates this vote on the minimum wage tied to this estate tax cut. And frankly, the moderate Republicans felt they had to go along with this. Very few Democrats did, by the way. Only 34 Democrats voted for the combined estate tax minimum wage cut. So I think if this gambit fails, and I think it will in the Senate on Friday, I think Congress will come back in September and there'll be enormous pressure to pass a clean minimum wage increase. Because, as I said, nobody wants to go home and face the voters having failed to raise the minimum wage when it has become this public and this powerful an issue.
Now, of course, they tried the estate tax alone in the past, and that went nowhere. They couldn't get the votes to pass it. But
that's why we call it a poison pill. You know, adding the minimum wage to the estate tax almost guarantees failure because the estate tax cut has been rejected in the Senate.
How do you think it'll be rejected? Do you think there'll be a filibuster? You think they won't get the 60 votes?
There will be a filibuster. The majority leader will file cloture, which basically says that debate will end if we can get 60 votes to cut off debate, the supermajority. And I don't think he'll get 60 votes. I think he'll fall short, and therefore the bill will fail.
They're trying, though, to sweeten everything. I know they're giving stuff to the lumber industry to try to get Maria Cantwell. There's the $30 billion to pay for abandoned landmines. Talk about a waste of money. The idea is corporations who are making all this money off energy costs don't have to pay for their own pollution, for their own abandoned landmines. Taxpayers have to. But apparently that helps West Virginia, Robert Byrd and Jay Rockefeller. Do you think they'll succeed with all these corporate sweeteners and peeling off a few Democrats and maybe even pass this?
Well, I actually think there is support for some of these other tax provisions. As you mentioned, the estate tax by itself would fail and has failed. They've added a whole bunch of other tax items. These are so-called extenders. They extend tax provisions that are expiring, deductions for research and development, deductions for college loans, that sort of thing. These are pretty popular tax breaks. I think there'll be a lot of pressure if this bill fails to bring that up separately. Again, it's the same as the minimum wage. And this effort to tie them all together and say to the Senate, take it or leave it, won't work. I think the Democrats and a handful of Republicans will say no, and the leadership will have to come back in September and start dealing with them individually. And I think they will pass the tax extender bill. I don't think they'll pass the estate tax. I think that's finished. And I think they will vote to raise the minimum wage. But by the way, during the break, I checked on those states that have tip employee and protections, and actually Oregon is one of them. So I was wrong when I told your callers.
Okay,
Oregon actually has a minimum wage, state minimum wage of $7.50. So tipped employees have to be paid at least $7.50. They don't get to take advantage of the tip credit that most other states have available to them. Washington is another one, as I mentioned. Their minimum wage is $7.63. California at $6.75. Tipped employees in those states, there's a few others, Montana, Nevada, and Alaska, make the state minimum wage. That's the lowest their employer can pay them. The rest of the states, they can pay tipped employees $2.13 an hour as long as tips bring them up to the federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. So if this law takes effect, tipped employees in Oregon will see a pay cut of $5.37.
They'd lose $5.37, but they'd get their tips.
That's right. They'd have $2.13 guaranteed from their employer, and then they, of course, get their tips on top of that.
Whereas right now, they're guaranteed $7.50 under Oregon law.
With their tips on top of that. So it really is. It's a pay cut. It's a pay cut for a lot of workers.
It certainly is. We have to take a break. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You can also comment on the blog, as some of you would like to do. If you'd rather write rather than call in, just go to RadioInsideScoop.com, put your comments down, and we'll read them on the air. We'll be right back after this.
James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Did you receive an email from the IRS saying you're due a tax refund? If so, don't open it. The IRS does not request personal information by email. Hi, I'm Russell George, Treasury Inspector General for Tax. The IRS and I want to warn you about bogus IRS emails and websites that look real, but are not. These emails are schemes played by crooks who are out to steal your money and identity. Fall victim to it, and you can spend months, even years, cleaning up the mess they've made of your good name and credit record. Help stop these crooks from ripping people off. If you get a suspicious email, forward it to phishing@irs.gov. That's phishing at irs.gov. Or call us at 1-800-366-4484. Again, that's 1-800-366-4484. Thank you.
The Native American Journalists Association is calling out to tomorrow's reporters, photographers, editors, and publishers to represent Native perspectives.
Today's agreement allows the Nebraska State Patrol and Winnebago Tribal Police to share enforcement.
The tribe is taking its concerns to the Bureau of Reclamation, which manages and
Native American inmates have filed suit against the prison.
Go to NAJA.com to learn more about membership and benefits. NAJA, raising the next generation of storytellers.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the minimum wage and what's going on in Congress, and indeed the crass, cynical politics practiced by the Republican majority in combining a minimum wage increase, which is sorely necessary, with an amazing giveaway, not just to the super rich, but to the laziest among the super rich, those that do absolutely nothing to earn their money but sit there and earn it as heirs. And we're talking about people who get more than $10 million. I don't know why it is that our government feels that poor people apparently don't need a couple more bucks an hour, but people who do nothing need to earn $10 million tax-free. My guest is Bill Samuel. He's a legislative director for the AFL-CIO. It's interesting, you know, Bill, I get asked all the time by people who don't really understand how it works in Congress, and they read their social studies textbook, and they think that if a majority in the Senate and a majority in the House support a bill, it gets passed. And I have to tell them all the time, I'm sorry, that's just not the way it works. You can have a supermajority in both houses, but if the leadership, in this case the Republican Party, the people who are controlling both houses don't want that legislation to come to the floor, it just won't come to the floor. And so my question for you is, what is the AFL-CIO doing to both defeat this current legislation and to get an alternative minimum wage bill on the floor?
Well, we've been working in just about every state to make the minimum wage an election issue. In some states, that means challenging your member of Congress or senator if he or she is up for election on the minimum wage. And in at least six states, we've put it on the ballot. As I mentioned, 22 states have a higher state minimum wage that takes precedence over the federal minimum wage. So in six additional states, it's going to be on the ballot because of our efforts and the efforts of many of our allies, Ohio, Colorado, Arizona, they raised it in Florida and Nevada last year, or two years ago.
You're going state by state. Are we not going to get a national minimum wage unless, if the Democrats took over Congress, if they got a majority in the House and the Senate, then presumably the leadership could just call it up and pass it in a second.
Well, the Senator Reid, who would be the majority leader, and Nancy Pelosi, who would be the speaker, have already said they would do it in the first 100 hours. So you've got a commitment
from not even 100 days.
That's right. You've got a commitment from the Democratic leaders, were they to take over their respective chambers, that they would act to increase the minimum wage basically in the first week. It would be on its way to the president. Now, of course, the president will still be George Bush for two more years. He would
right.
have to sign it or veto it. And at that point, you'd need to have the two-thirds necessary to override a veto.
I just could wonder, this president, who's only exercised one veto in his entire history, and that was on embryonic stem cell research, would exercise that veto to make sure that the working people don't get a small raise. I think it'd be a tough bill for him to veto.
Well, it would, and it depends on to what degree this is seen as a mandate from the people. So if the election turns out well for Democrats, if the ballot initiatives in the six states I mentioned pass overwhelmingly and the minimum wage is raised, and some of these states, by the way, Montana is another one I didn't mention that has it on the ballot. If it passes overwhelmingly in Montana, I think that'll be a signal that even in red states, these are states that voted for George Bush in 2004, if they support an increase, I think it would be very tough for the president to veto this increase. And in 2004, as I was pointing out a moment ago, voters in Florida and Nevada raised their state minimum wages, even though both states went for Bush, Nevada narrowly and Florida not quite as close. So the minimum wage, as it turns out, the minimum wage is a very popular issue, certainly among Democrats, but just as popular among Republicans. It consistently polls in the 75 to 80% range positively, and that's in all areas of the country.
Well, one of the things I've never understood is why don't you get indexing on the minimum wage? We do it with Social Security. We do it with the cost of living adjustments for federal employees. We do it even now with tax rates. It would seem to me that, in fact, even employers would prefer knowing that it goes up at the rate of inflation. You could even make it so that it goes up an even 25 cents so that if inflation isn't enough, it doesn't go up one year, and another year it jumps up to 50 cents. It would be a very clear number for everyone to know. They'd know in advance. Has labor pushed for indexing the minimum wage?
Actually, we have. And at the state level, that really has taken root. In Nevada and Florida, when they voted to increase their state minimum wage 2 years ago, they did index it to the Consumer Price Index, cost of living. The six ballot initiatives that I just mentioned on the ballot this year are all indexed to the CPI. The federal minimum wage has never been indexed. It's been a very controversial idea. I guess part of the explanation is we've had such a hard time just raising the minimum wage by itself, much less indexing it so that it increases every year by itself. It's certainly an idea whose time.
Why do you think that is?
Well,
even when Democrats controlled the Congress, why wasn't it indexed then?
Well, I think when Democrats controlled the Congress, they probably believed that they would always control the Congress and that they could vote to increase the minimum wage periodically as they had done for many years. It really wasn't that big an issue. A couple of years would go by, but it would be increased by the majority party. I think now the Republicans have been in control for 10 years. It may be that if the Democrats get back in control, that they would look at it somewhat differently. Now, there is a lot of opposition to indexing it. Obviously, people who oppose raising the minimum wage, they don't want it to go up automatically.
So that would be businesses largely?
Well, yeah, of course, the Restaurant Association, the small businesses. By the way, congressional pay is essentially indexed.
Sure.
It goes up every year. Unless
that's true. In fact, they designed it really carefully so they don't have to look like they're voting for it. It's all like, well, if we do nothing, then it goes up, and then we don't vote against it. It's a very convoluted way of getting themselves pay increases.
That's right. And some tax breaks are indexed so that as people make more money, they stay in the same bracket. Not the the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, but there are other tax provisions in the code that are indexed. So there are a lot of programs where inflation does not take a bite out of whatever the benefit is. But minimum wage has not been one of them, and as a result, you see it stagnate for 10 years, and it's now worth less than it has in 50 years. The value has been eaten away and then some by inflation.
If you index only to inflation, if that's all you do, then you could keep in a lower wage in effect than has been there historically in the past. I've wondered why it's only going up from 515 to 725 and how that rate compares in real wages after inflation wages with minimum wages in the past.
Well, it's actually an interesting point. When the minimum wage was first adopted in the 1930s, it was set at essentially one-half the average hourly rate, so that it was not set to the average wage, but one half. If it were to peg it to that same level, it would be well over $8 now, because the average hourly wage is, I guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of $16 an hour. That's the problem. It's not only much lower than average wages, but it's fallen well behind even inflation, so that its purchasing power has really diminished, and that's why. So far below the poverty level when you're working a minimum wage job.
In 1996, the last time the minimum wage was increased, was it up to half the average wage, or was that even
not quite? Not quite. It's really been somewhat less for many years. I think back in the 60s, it was that high, but it's been very hard to keep it at that level.
We have to take another break. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You can comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. Or if you just want to chat amongst yourselves, go to the headonradionetwork.com/chatroom, and I promise not to read your comments there on air. We'll be right back after this.
United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Go back to the phones, and we are joined by Beauregard T. Clampett, I'm told, on line one.
Hello there, Bob.
Well, Mr. Clampett, how are you, sir?
It's fine, sir. You have had a ruckus on the airwaves this evening, Bob, and I just got to tell you where I fall down on this subject.
And fall down you do, I suppose.
So you catch on quick, I tell you. You're very quick, very quick. But I wanted to, because I kept hearing things like amnesty, and I had to tell you, Bob, if we have amnesty, we can't work them to death like we're doing. We can't pay them $3 an hour if we let them become citizens now, can we?
That whole 13th Amendment thing's still a thorn in your side, isn't it?
We won't talk about that either, Bob. Now, we're working on repealing that sucker, but it's going to take a while.
Catch Bob Kincaid weeknights, 7 to 10 p.m., right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Good man underground.
Head On. What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community could also have an effect on your own. Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business. Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS. What if you established your own path? One that others might follow. Would you rather make your own way? Or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580. Or go to peacecorps.gov.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We've got a few minutes left with my guest, Bill Samuel. He's the legislative director for the AFL-CIO. And Bill, I guess when I think about the minimum wage, I guess I think about the overall problems, which it's not fun to talk about, but with labor and the Democratic Party, it seems like that we're fighting a losing battle. I'm hoping it changes in the election, but labor membership is down. We have wages going down, and we have poor people in areas like, well, you mentioned Montana, but Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma. Some of the states that most go for Republicans and most go for Bush are some of the poorest states in the country, Alabama, Mississippi. How do you explain why the Democrats and labor, perhaps, are not getting their message out to poor people?
Well, that's a very complicated question. There are, you know, I'm sorry?
I said I know it's a tough question, but...
I mean, I'm not sure I know the answer either. I think obviously, when there's a Republican president, he has the megaphone. It's voters who don't read newspapers carefully and maybe don't have time to watch the evening news. Basically, they hear little bits and pieces here, and the news they hear is for the most part, you know, from the White House and from the majority in Congress, which has the biggest megaphone. Labor itself, of course, we've been under the gun for a number of years from corporations who've gotten more aggressive, spent more money to try to defeat workers' rights, workers who are organizing to try to have a voice on the job and to bargain collectively. And I think the whole introduction, and this is nothing new, of these so-called wedge issues, whether it's gun control or gay marriage or abortion, has really, you know, in some ways replaced the debate that we ought to be having about the economy. And I think, in my own theory, is that the Republicans who have been governing for some time now have really convinced most Americans that the government can't or won't do anything to help them economically. They won't improve their situation with regard to rising health costs, the rising cost of education, the decline in pension security. People don't believe government can or will do anything about that, so they end up focusing on gay marriage and flag burning and abortion. On that, of course, many Republicans demagogue the issue and end up taking votes away from the Democrats. And I think that's the problem.
So a lot of the poorest people are perhaps some of the most fundamentalist in their religious outlook, and that affects their...
You know, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I think they're resigned to the fact that government's not going to do anything to help them financially. They probably do care about their family finances. You know, they sit around the kitchen table like anybody else, whether they're in Mississippi or New York. But the fact is, I think everybody has been convinced that the government's not going to step in. They have, after all, they haven't raised the minimum wage in 10 years. They haven't had a serious debate about expanding access to quality health care. They haven't had a serious discussion about retirement security. So I think most people believe the government really doesn't have a role to play in their family's finances. I think that's unfortunate because government can help. It certainly did during FDR's time, and they can again.
Let me ask you, what about labor? I mean, it seems like you're having trouble organizing. Is it the new service economy that's the problem? Is it government laws that's the problem? The way wages are today? I mean, union membership is down. What's going on there?
Well, union membership is pretty flat and has been for some time. Again, a lot of reasons. We have a government that is on the side of corporations. The government agency, the National Labor Relations Board, which is supposed to oversee free and fair elections by unions who are trying to organize, is very much tilted on the side of corporations and businesses. businesses themselves are now spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year to defeat union organizing drives. Walmart is probably the best.
Walmart, known, yeah, that's a classic example.
The best known example, but frankly, in somewhere in excess of 90% of the union organizing drives, the company hires an anti-union firm. They begin to assault workers with threats and coercive material, suggesting that if they bring in the union, they're going to close the shop. This is very typical now, but it was not typical 20 and 30 years ago when workers were basically free to choose a union. At that time, many did. The union membership was, you know, 35% of the workforce, like it is in most of Western Europe. But both government and business has really joined forces to defeat unions and break unions, and that's really not debatable as far as I'm concerned.
No, but it isn't, and unfortunately, there really hasn't been a lot of press about these tactics. So I want to end on an optimistic rather than a pessimistic note. What is labor doing? What's the AFL-CIO doing to help change these numbers?
Well, we're fighting back on two fronts. In terms of organizing, we have legislation pending before the House and the Senate. It's called the Employee Free Choice Act. It would allow workers to organize as soon as a majority of them decide they want to belong to a union. The employer has to begin bargaining. That's the way the law originally envisioned.
I was just going to say, isn't that been the law since the 30s?
Well, it has been, but over the years, it's actually been perverted. Now there has to be an election, a secret ballot election, which occurs after the employer has had several months to campaign against the union. And it's such an unequal relationship that workers don't really have a free and fair choice. It's nothing like elections that you and I think of when we think of a, you know, congressional election or a city council election, where, you know, people on both sides have equal access to the voters. They both can raise money.
They may futz with the numbers after the election, but that's really a suffer
right.
for another.
That's about as bad as it gets. In any case, so we have this bill pending in Congress. I think that would help improve the environment for organizing. In the House, we have 216 co-sponsors. It only takes 218 to get a majority. In the Senate, we have 42 co-sponsors. Of course, there it could take as many as 60 if there's a filibuster. But we're making headway there.
So the election would make a real difference in that bill then?
That would make a big difference. Politically, we have a very big program we've put together for the fall election. Labor is going to spend in excess of $40 million to educate its own members, to educate our members, to mobilize them, to register them, and get them to the polls, to get them to vote for pro-working family candidates. So hopefully we'll have a new Congress. We'll have a Congress that will take up some of these changes in labor law. The minimum wage will, for the first time in a while, talk seriously about national health insurance and retirement security. I think we should end on an optimistic note, because we are optimistic.
And let me ask you just one last question. We only got about a minute and a half left. But in terms of pensions, a lot of workers have seen their pensions not be funded at all. In fact, some of the airlines have broken the law and not funded pensions. What can the Congress do and what can labor do to help make sure that people's retirement is there?
Well, I think we do need a change in the law. Right now, of course, pensions are voluntary. If employers don't have to provide pensions, if there's a union, of course, you know, oftentimes it's bargained for, and then the company has to live up to the terms of the agreement. But there's no law that says that a company has to provide a pension. All you're guaranteed is the Social Security Act and anything you can save. We think Congress ought to begin working on legislation that would, really much more strongly encourage and maybe even mandate that employers set aside some money for their workers' retirement, some form of pension benefits that, together with Social Security, would be a reasonable, standard of living for retirees. As far as companies,
if they're contractually obligated to do it, they should at least be doing it.
They're contractually obligated to do it. They should be doing it. There are a few cases where employers have not done it. I think the law, for the most part, can address that. Now, in the airline industry, there is a bill moving through Congress which will give them a little more time to fund those plans. And frankly, the employees want to give their employers a little more time, because it doesn't do any good if a company's flat on its back because of fuel prices or 9/11 to have to make